sit back, relax, and take a ride with us on the Gunblog Variety Cast, episode 10. Gunblog Variety Cast. I'm your host, Sean from NC Gunblog, and with me today again this week is Adam from Guns Cars Tech Blog. How are you doing? And how's your wife doing? And how's your baby doing?
So you remember a couple of weeks ago when I said, I'm so tired? Yeah, that was a lie. Now I'm so tired. So baby's doing great. Mom's doing great. Mom is continually reminding me that waking up three times in the middle of the night with a 1 week old is totally okay. So, but yeah, I had to take a nap yesterday. Luckily for me, I've got FMLA and some other pretty good benefits, so I'm off work for like a month.
Family and Medical Leave Act.
Yep. Now, when my first son was born, I had only been there for like 6 weeks, so I didn't have any FMLA. I had no vacation time. I just took a week unpaid.
Ooh.
It's working out much better this time.
Well, good. Well, let's start with the Tactical Dog and Fitness Report. I'm still suffering from back pain, so no bike riding this week. 33.6 miles with Isis, and the Frisbee's coming along very well. She is loving chasing the Frisbee and jumping in the air and catching it.
Fantastic. Well, for me, now that I'm home during the day, Tactical Dog seems to be sleeping a lot more at night. So I guess she's not sleeping when she's in her crate. She's just kind of running around. We're playing tug all the time, going outside playing, you know, two stick. So I feel like she's going to do really well on her weigh-in tomorrow. So I'll report next week. We'll see.
Well, now it's time for Blue Collar Prepping with that bratty kid sister of the gun blogosphere, Aaron. Aaron wants to tell us about pasteurization of water? So, Aaron, water is the most important thing in any survival situation. And let's say I don't have that bleach that you were talking about in the first episode, and I don't have some fancy-schmancy filter pump thingy. So, what can I do to make my water safe to drink? I mean, I could just boil it, right?
Well, yes, Sean, you could boil it, but actually, you don't have to.
Don't have to boil it?
No, you don't. While boiling will kill most of the things in there, I think there's one or two that boiling won't get. The problem is that you have to spend a lot of time and gather a lot of fuel raising your water to the boiling point. And if you're in a survival situation, you may not have all that fuel. You may not have that time. But there's a way you can purify your water. You can kill the pathogens without having to raise it to the boiling point. And you do that by raising it to pasteurization temperature.
You mean like milk?
Yeah, like with milk?
Yeah, exactly like you do with milk. And you only have to raise your water or your milk to 149 degrees Fahrenheit or 65 degrees Celsius for about 6 minutes. And that will kill the pathogens.
That's great, but my finger's not calibrated to 149 degrees. How do I know that the water's going to be... I mean, I don't have bleach. What am I supposed to carry, a candy thermometer with me?
Well, I suppose you could if you wanted to, Sean. But there is a handy little device that I'm recommending, and it's called the Water Purification Indicator, also known as a WAPI. And it's a really simple and ingenious device, and really what it is a glob of wax with a very specific thermal property, and it's enclosed in a short plastic tube with a weighted bit of fishing line at each end.
So what do I do with that?
To use it, all you do is you place it in the water that you want to purify with the wax at the top of the tube. And I mentioned it has a very specific thermal property, and that's this. When it reaches pasteurization temperature, the wax melts and flows to the other end. So when you're watching your water and you notice that the wax is at the bottom instead of the top, you know that your water is safe to drink.
Interesting.
I don't think that could really be any simpler.
I don't think it can be either. And here's another thing. It's reusable. All you have to do is take it out, let it cool down, let the wax harden, turn it over so that once again the wax is at top, put it in your water, you can use it again, and again, and again, and again.
That is so simple. That is like dirt simple. Why didn't any of us think of this?
No kidding.
I don't know, Sean. The first time I saw it, I couldn't figure out how I didn't think of it either.
Now, I'm sure it would be important when it's cooling for you to hang it so that the wax doesn't, you know, settle on its side.
Well, yes, that is an important consideration.
Yeah, yeah. You know, just mentioning that.
Well, it is a good point, and you do want to give it enough time to cool. I don't know how long it takes. I know that on mine it sets up fairly quickly, so you can probably do it between boiling cups of water.
Or you could just stick it in the next container of cold water.
That would also work. Now, on top of it being very simple, it's also very lightweight. When I ordered mine, it was mailed to me in just a regular envelope.
Okay, so how expensive is this wildly complicated piece of kit?
This incredibly complicated piece of equipment can be bought for $8 on Amazon.
I couldn't even build something for $8. That's $8 of me not cutting my fingers and swearing at my wife because I got it wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that I could probably figure out how to work one of these, but it would cost me way more than $8 of my time.
But hey, included in the show notes are instructions on how to build your own if you want to. The only trick is that you need to buy that special wax because you can't just get it down at the hardware store. But everything else you can get, it's all, you know, fishing line and brass weights and plastic tube.
Aaron, you bring us the best stuff. This is really cool.
This is great. Yeah.
Yeah. I really like it. I've used it. I swear by it. I think it belongs in every prepper's get home bag and bug out bag.
All right, Aaron, where can we find more easy, simple ways to extend our lifespan in some difficult circumstances without spending all of our money?
Well, you can go to my website, bluecollarprepping.blogspot.com. We're there 6 days a week, Sean.
All right, Aaron. It's good to have you and see you next week.
Bye, guys.
If you'd like to read more from Aaron, check out her personal blog, lurkingrhythmically.blogspot.com. Felons behaving badly. This one's made the rounds on social media today. One thing that everybody seems to be missing is the records of the people involved. So let's talk about it. There was a shooting in Lumberton.
Is that Lumberton, North Carolina?
Lumberton, North Carolina. For those who have been in the Army at Fort Bragg, Lumberton is like the next county over. It's fairly close. Now, out of the Robesonian, it's in Robeson County. The headline is, I heard pow, pow, pow. Neighbors say at least one man suspected in a violent home invasion on Yetta Road this week knew the victims and they believe the family was targeted. 67-year-old Kenneth Bird suffered at least 8 gunshot wounds during a home invasion late Monday night, according to neighbors who helped him immediately after the incident. His wife, Judy Bird, 65, and teenage granddaughter were severely beaten. One of the suspected intruders died as a result of gunshot wounds inflicted during the burglary, while 2 others remain hospitalized. One of their neighbors said that she thinks the men were looking for prescription pills, knowing that the Birds have medical conditions. The woman's mother said that she heard shots ring out from inside her home on the quiet, secluded street. Questions about what was happening began being answered when a bloodied Kenneth Bird, her neighbor of 20 years, banged on the door. I don't know how he ever made it across that road, said the woman. According to the neighbor and her daughter, Bird's heart was pierced by a bullet. He had been shot 4 times in the leg, 3 times in the arm, shattering his bone. His head was beaten so badly they feared he'd been shot there too. While waiting for the ambulance to arrive, Kenneth Bird was lucid. He had trouble breathing, the woman said. But he was able to clearly describe a little of what had happened, although for whatever reason he refused to come inside. He kept looking over towards the house, she said. The woman said there were no strange cars outside the home and said the intruders must have been on foot. They eventually fled the home in Kenneth Bird's gold Cadillac, which was later found about 6 miles away by sheriff's deputies on Singletary Church Road. Suspect number 1 was found dead with a gunshot wound.
Yay!
The Bird's next-door neighbor, Henry Pittman, said that he was watching television when he heard gunshots come from the residence. I heard pow, pow, pow and knew something was going on, said Pittman, who has known and lived next to the couple for more than 20 years. Pittman said that he stepped outside to investigate the noise and saw a bloody Kenneth Bird across the street hollering for help outside the other neighbor's house. They beat Kenneth. I mean, they beat him bad, Pittman said. A few moments later, the Bird's teenage granddaughter managed to escape a window and ran across the yard to Pittman's home for sanctuary. According to a statement from the sheriff's office, the intruders attempted to rape the 19-year-old during the burglary. The Robesonian has elected not to publish her name. Pittman said that the teenager was partially dressed and that her clothes were torn. According to a sheriff's statement, the couple were forced into the back room before Kenneth Bird recovered a gun and exchanged fire with the intruder. They got what they deserved, Pittman said. They kicked in the wrong door. According to Pittman, Kenneth Bird doesn't believe in banks, and he has told people that he keeps large sums of cash inside his home. The couple has many friends, Pittman said. Pittman said that it was just like Bird's character to take care of himself, take care of everything in the house, then get across the street for help. The old man showed me, he said. I'm proud of him.
Before we get into the records of the suspects, this is the reason why I have a gun on me all the time when I'm at home. You know, sometimes people are like, oh, yeah, well, you know, I get home and I take it off, and, you know, or, yeah, I have a gun at home for protection. I keep it, you know, in the closet. Yeah, no, mine's in my pocket right now. Because you never know when somebody's just going to bust in your door because they heard a rumor that you've got drugs and money.
Yep. For drugs and money, they put 8 bullets in a man.
67 years old and, you know, was able to walk across the street. Good for him.
Yeah. I put this on Facebook as badass grandpa is badass.
Yeah.
He had a granddaughter and a wife to protect. And so he did. So the person that was ended up dead does not appear to have any sort of record in North Carolina, at least not a conviction record. Suspect number 2, wounded and currently in the hospital. He has robbery with a dangerous weapon, carry concealed weapon, possession of a firearm by a felon, possession schedule 2, robbery with a dangerous weapon conspiracy, felony breaking and entering, larceny over 1,000, 2 counts of driver's license revoked, larceny, felony breaking and entering, possessing stolen goods, simple assault affray. It keeps going and it keeps going and keeps going.
So he's an all-around nice guy. He's well-rounded. There's some violence
wonderful,
there,
wonderful,
some theft.
Wonderful human being who spent a total of 9 years in prison in his 28 years on this planet.
Nice.
This does not include any possible prison time that he spent as juvenile. This is just as an adult.
Hmm.
Most of his adult life has been spent in prison.
Yeah.
Suspect number 3, also wounded and in the hospital, is 17 years old, has never been incarcerated, but he's also been convicted of larceny after breaking and entering vehicles, larceny, breaking and entering vehicles, larceny.
So he liked to steal stuff.
Yep. Likes to steal. He's a felon. He is 17 years old, and he's a felon from 2013. So he was, what, 15 at the time?
Yeah.
15 or 16?
Yeah.
So, I mean, who knows what he was doing as a juvenile? And, of course, somebody will say, oh, he fell in with the bad crowd. Guess what? He was the bad crowd.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. And he also will qualify as one of those children shot by firearms.
Yeah. Unfortunately, him being 17, he's not eligible for the death penalty. Because I really think, you know, that this qualifies in North Carolina, they have the felony murder rule. So he qualifies for murder 1, I believe, because he is engaged in a violent felony, attempting to rape somebody, and somebody ends up dead in the process. That's felony murder in this state.
Good.
So I will echo what the neighbor Pittman said. They got what they deserved. They kicked
Absolutely.
The wrong door in. I urge all of our listeners to be that wrong door.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There is such a thing as righteous violence, and that's it.
Well, Nikki Kenyon wants to talk to us about unaccompanied minor illegal aliens in Foreign Policy for Grownups. Nikki, I'm seeing more and more about these unaccompanied minors that are crossing the border into America. How did these people become our responsibility?
Unaccompanied minors crossing the border and illegal aliens crossing the border is really nothing new or different. We've had porous borders for a long time. But this year, thousands of unaccompanied minors made their way from Central and South America into the United States. They've caused a huge strain on our infrastructure. They've caused a backlog of cases in immigration courts. There's insufficient space to house them until their case comes up. So there's a ton of children, probably in the 40 and 50,000 range, waiting
whoa,
around.
Whoa, 40 or 50,000?
That is correct. That is correct. This summer, I believe I read there were 43,000 illegal immigrant unaccompanied minors crossing into the country. And these kids wait on average 578 days before they're even heard in court. So they are expensive. You've got to house them. You've got to find some relatives for them to stay with. You've got to find foster families. They've cost billions of dollars. The administration back in June requested $1.57 billion in emergency funding to house, feed, process, and transport these kids before they can be released to join relatives or to be placed in foster care. That doesn't include costs for their medical care. It doesn't include costs for their schooling. All of this stuff that they are costing us, the question is, are we responsible?
Well, why did they come here?
Well, there are several reasons. Obviously, poverty is a big one. So Central and South American countries are generally fairly poor. There's high youth unemployment. There's cartel violence. There's murders. Many are being smuggled in for cheap labor or prostitution. There's homicides in their home countries. Their families are getting killed. So there are lots of reasons why these kids come over here.
The fact that they show up on our doorstep, what makes them our responsibility?
Well, you know, it's a good question. We as Americans are very kind, generous people. We want to help little kids. You know, we want to protect the innocent. It's a good question as to why is it our responsibility. They do put a strain on our infrastructure. A lot of them carry infectious diseases. They're unvaccinated. A lot of these teens that come over join gangs or are already part of criminal organizations. It also costs extra to educate them. They need ESL classes. They need extra teachers. They need extra books. They need extra space. A lot of these school systems just weren't ready for the influx of these kids. So it's going to cost thousands of dollars each year to educate these extra kids for each child.
Yes, but that doesn't answer my question. Why are they our responsibility? Why can't we just push them back?
That's a good question, and a lot of people have been asking that question for the very reason that I've listed. And really, you know, it comes down to us being a very generous people. We have a fairly robust welfare system. We want to help. So a lot of people will tell you, well, it's our responsibility because they're already here. And because they're little and because they're defenseless. And as a country, we have a responsibility to help the most defenseless of us. Now, I'm not saying this is a particularly good reason, but it is a reason. And with our 24-hour-a-day news cycle and the coverage of these kids who are small and starving and don't have clothes and don't have food and don't have parents or medical care, you see a lot of people becoming very upset and heartbroken over this. So are they technically our responsibility? Do we have a legal obligation to these kids? Probably not. But if you have a ton of Americans who are kind of bleeding hearty, so to speak, and they watch these 24-hour news cycles and they see these poor little kids, the politicians respond.
Well, what's causing this to happen? What's the underlying cause?
A lot of libertarians and actually some conservatives as well are claiming that this is the result of the failed drug war. Cartels in their countries corrupt public institutions, they destroy the rule of law, and they cause violence. The criminals have the financial power to overwhelm the law in those countries because of this insatiable U.S. demand for drugs, particularly cocaine, heroin, meth. All of these are produced in Latin America and they're smuggled into the United States. And as long as there's a demand, there will be a supply. And this is not coming from some pie-in-the-sky radical libertarian. This is actually from Marine Corps General John Kelly. He understands that, indeed, this is a problem. As long as there's a demand on the U.S. side for drugs, there will always be transnational organized criminal organizations and drug cartels willing to supply it.
How does our border situation play into this, our open borders we seem to have?
Well, we do have the open borders, and as much as the administration is going to claim that the borders are more secure than they ever were. Fact of the matter is, there are miles and miles and miles of unmonitored borders. The human traffickers always find a way to smuggle these people in here. And once they're here and, you know, they present this very kind of pathetic picture. Once they're in here, you have a very large portion of the population who begins to feel sorry for them. Well, they're here. We have to take care of them. It's our duty as Christians. It's our duty as Americans. It's our duty as insert, you know, do-gooder organization here. So the open borders do have a huge role to play in this. I think that if the situation in their own countries was actually better, I don't think we'd have so many people being smuggled into this country and so many people wanting to leave. Why would you want to leave a good situation?
I understand that. All right, Nikki, it was good to have you and see you next week.
You bet. Take care.
Nikki blogs at thelibertyzone.com. Strange gun laws. What do you got for me, Adam?
So, Sean, this one is one of my favorite ones from Ohio. Now, I've never been to Ohio. I've never lived in Ohio. But
it's not
I
a
heard
bad
about
place.
This one. That's what I understand. I heard about this one through another story where it was just kind of an ancillary detail to the actual story. But, Sean, what is an automatic firearm?
Well, like a machine gun. You pull the trigger and it keeps firing. It fires more than one bullet.
Right.
Pull the
right.
trigger.
So that's you know, the commonly accepted definition. Well, in Ohio, an automatic firearm means any firearm designed or specially adapted to fire a succession of cartridges with a single function of the trigger.
There
right?
we go. Yeah.
Right. The next sentence is, automatic firearm also means any semi-automatic firearm designed or specially adapted to fire more than 31 cartridges without reloading, other than a firearm chambering only 22 caliber short, long, or long rifle cartridges. So what this means is that your Glock 19 with a 33-round factory stick mag, if you load all 33 rounds in there, is now a machine gun.
Well, it's an automatic firearm.
Oh, yes, automatic firearm. This is much like defining motorcycles as vehicles that have two wheels and also vehicles that have four wheels. A vehicle with four wheels is not a motorcycle. So don't take your stick mags to Ohio.
Yeah, I did notice that one of the lawyer websites said, there is some question about the constitutionality of this law. Do you think?
There's some question to the rationality of this law.
Yeah, there's another good way to put it. Well, Miguel wants to talk to us about the history of Hollywood and gun control. Miguel, I feel a bit like a Johnny-come-lately to being an activist in gun control, gun rights. I hear horror stories about what it was like in 1990s compared to what it is now. You were actually active and paying a lot of attention at that time. What was it like?
Oh, my God. The 90s was the horror, the dark ages, if you want to put it another way. I've been going back and reviewing the old archives on the internet, and I happened to bump into the Handgun Control, Inc. semi-annual report for 1992. The things that we're doing, the things that we're accomplishing, and how bad we were at the time, well, it was just, it would just drive people insane nowadays. I mean, we are riding now on the backs of the giants that we had back then that didn't stop. And what has changed so much is just amazing.
Well, 1992, they were heading in towards 1994's assault weapons ban.
And the Brady Bill.
So this was all at the height of gun control.
They were riding high.
Their semi-annual report, what kind of stuff did they have in a semi-annual report in 92?
Okay, I got one that I love. You know, you keep telling you that the Hollywood, you know, they're doing their stuff and they are for not for gun violence and they do it out of the goodness of their hearts and because they are, you know, better. In this report, there's a little a bit of info that is amazing. It's called The Entertainers Joint Fight Against Gun Violence. And you have the bit there.
Yeah, let me read that. The center, which refers to Handgun Control, Inc., which later became the Brady Campaign, the center's Los Angeles-based Entertainment Resources Division is working with entertainers, writers, and producers in an effort to get gun violence prevention themes incorporated into television, music, and films. In August, the center held its first, quote, lot briefing at Universal Studios, attended by more than 100 writers, producers, actors, and entertainment executives to familiarize them with the issues of gun violence and to share ideas. CPHV Chair Sarah Brady was joined by Michael Chitwood, Police Chief of Portland, Maine, and Garen Wintermute, MD, We all know about Dr. Wintermute, mm-hmm. a nationally recognized health and gun violence prevention expert. The briefing included motivating and informative sessions on the issues of guns in the home, guns in schools, guns and self-protection, and children and guns. A similar briefing was held in November at Warner Brothers Studios. The Entertainment Resources Division will continue to encourage industry professionals to portray the tragic consequences of gun violence in their creative projects.
Well, ain't that amazing? And they keep telling you, you know, there's no collusion between Hollywood and the gun control people. That just comes out of the goodness of their hearts. And we have here that they were taking classes on how to expand the gun control agenda.
Yeah, it's amazing to me how they're just so open about it. Hey, we went and we indoctrinated these actors and producers and writers and said, hey, look at how bad guns are. We need to show that in our movies.
One of the greatest examples was, you know, Richard Donner, a director of the Lethal Weapon series.
Okay, yeah, I remember that.
And Richard Donner, and there was a really bad movie with Sylvester Stallone and Antonio Banderas called Assassins. And there's one scene in, you know, this car chase and whatnot, and they're bouncing off a bus, a municipal bus, and on the side of the bus is this huge anti-NRA signs. They were not real, they were made for the movie. Donner hated and still hates the NRA, okay? And he come up on Lethal Weapon 2 or 3, I forget which one, he talks about the infamous cop killer bullets. We still haven't seen one single instance of a cop killing bullet killing a cop or anybody else for that matter.
Yeah.
Okay, but go through his movies now and, you know, grab a checkpoint list on from gun control and everything, and that list is going to be in his movies.
Yep.
And we see that, and we still see that every day. And still see it nowadays.
Yeah, it's amazing to me how flying high they seem to be in this report. It's not, oh, here's some things we'd like to do. It's like, here's the things we are doing. We are pushing. We are winning. You can see and you can feel just by reading this, they feel that they're effective. Like now, they're all whistling past the graveyard.
At that time, they were very powerful. They control, as you can imagine, they can control the media. We had no voice. The NRA had no voice whatsoever. They asked you to come to a show. You were sure that you were going to get the worst possible questions, and you were going to be edited out if you get good answers, or they were going to edit the answers in such a manner that it will make you look like a fool. You could count on that. No matter what, you were going to be portrayed as a crazy psycho ready to start killing babies. This is the beginning of the era of the internet. The internet was the great equalizer. With this, it allows to be organized, it allows to share information, and all of a sudden, they couldn't get away just with anything because it went out immediately. Somebody, for example, in North Carolina would make a comment about something that was going on, and somebody in Oregon say, hey, they tried this over here, you can get, and we did this. We start sharing information, we start sharing solutions. Internet's been a great equalizer. I keep saying that if Al Gore, he's the alleged father of the internet, ever figure out that the internet was going to be so effective for gun rights, he would have choked the baby with his umbilical cord.
That's true. And a very interesting book that all people should read if you want to know why the NRA and why gun rights succeeded even before the internet, but is succeeding even better after the internet, you should read Brian Anspatrick's Rise of the Anti-Media, Informing America's Concealed Weapon Carry Movement. He really explains how we in the gun rights movement had to share information with each other because there was no way we could count on the media ever telling us anything that we could use against gun control.
For people that were into the fight, they felt alone. I mean, they were felt that maybe, they would get a letter from the local or state guns organization, maybe one from the NRA, and that's about it. There was not that immediacy. That was not that, all of a sudden, hey, guys, we need maybe a donation, $10. And somebody from the other side of the country would send his $10. That was amazing.
All right, Miguel. Thanks very much, and I'll see you next week.
I'll see you next week.
Get more Miguel Gonzalez Daily at gunfreezone.net.
So I found this particularly interesting because I didn't get really kind of into guns until I was 17 or 18 years old. And I can remember Lethal Weapon 4. It came out about a year after I understood the difference between a semi-automatic weapon and a revolver. Like, that's how new I was.
Uh-huh.
And I watched that video, and I'll never forget, there's a scene in there where Chris Rock is standing in front of a poster that basically says, "Stop the NRA, they kill children." And I just was like, what? And that was my first experience of, wow, this you know, Hollywood really is anti-gun.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to find that these people were so open about, hey, we're going to indoctrinate our thought leaders and get them to propagandize for us against guns.
Yeah, well, obviously it worked really well.
Well, you know, we're back to that, oh, he fell in with a bad crowd. Now, you know, they were preaching to the converted there.
Yeah.
So, fun with headlines.
All right, so this one is pretty interesting. Inglewood woman calls offers to buy home bullying. So, what does that make you think of when you hear that headline? That maybe somebody has been coming by every day?
No, what I'm thinking is, I'd like to make to you an offer you can't refuse.
Well, it's nothing like that, and it's nothing like what I thought. No. If you read the article, and by the way, in the show notes, if you click on the link, there is an autoplay video, so just kind of, you know, be aware of that. She's getting notices in the mail. Yeah. Glenda Chrisman says she's gotten offers on her home for a long time, but recently got one that said it was the third notice, and it was urgent that someone talk to her about her property. Besides the intimidating look of the card, Chrisman says it bothered her that whoever it was wanted to keep this matter private. I would have thrown it in the trash, Chrisman said, but when they said to keep it to myself, wait a minute, now they're doing something wrong here. What are you doing that you don't want anyone else to know about? And that's basically the gist of the article. Yeah, so she's getting junk mail, and she called the media, because bullying.
Let's hope that she never discovers the internet.
Oh my gosh, yes. Yes.
I think this poor lady would have a heart attack if she ever read Twitter.
She might, yes. You know, there's people out there that do some really mean tweets.
Yeah, I hear that. Under Tennessee law, it is very difficult for anything in the mail to amount to harassment.
Yeah, I'm glad the reporter threw that in there. I you know, I would love to have been there when his editor gave him this story. He's been like, what? Really? Come on.
I'm guessing the editor probably didn't tell him. He just said, go on out there and get the story. And he's like, woohoo, she's getting bull. Wait a minute.
Wait, what? Yeah.
Oh, well, you know, in this modern world, it's not whether it's against any specific law. It's how
it
you
makes
feel
you
about
feel.
It. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Baron wants to talk about Facebook as data mining in Tech Tips with the Baron. Baron, I called my bank the other day, and in order to verify my identity, they asked me what my mother's maiden name was. Well, how is that useful for security? Pretty much anybody can figure that out.
That is absolutely the most useless thing in the world for security at this point, because honestly, with this wonderful thing called Facebook, it will take me probably at most an hour of me digging through your friends to figure out, oh, that's your aunt on your mom's side. Bingo, I now have maiden name. So honestly, at this point, remember how we were talking about last week how honestly it's bank fraud and the true victims of this type of crime are the banks, and the banks should be doing things to improve the situation? The use of your mother's maiden name is one of those prime examples of things that should absolutely positively be done away with. Other examples are things like your place of birth. Those are all easily obtainable. Things such as your first pet, again, with Facebook, it's obtainable. I can go find it. And when it comes to password reminders that you find on Google or otherwise where, here, answer these questions and we'll let you in because we're verifying you are who you say you are. Most of those questions, if you answer truthfully, I'm going to actually find my way through and I will gain access to your account. And once I gain access to your account, odds are I can then steal financial information tied to that account. If it's Facebook, you may have a card tied to it. If it's Google, you probably are using it for mail, and I can use that email address to then compromise other accounts. It's a very, very serious thing, and it's one of the reasons why I tell people, lie on the internet. Do not tell the truth. When it comes to those questions, do things that are completely off the wall. It isn't the town you were born in, it's blue magenta. It's some random color. You just need to remember what it is or store it in a password manager, or write it down someplace hidden off to the side. Because ultimately what it boils down to is somebody who is trying to groom information is going to need that to gain access to the account.
How is Facebook able to offer their services to me without charging me anything for it?
Because you are the product. You are what's being sold. They are directly advertising to you. I could actually direct advertisements directly at you. Someone else can direct advertisements at me. That is what they are selling. It's just like TV. The reason on-air TV exists is because they are selling your eyeballs to be glued to that TV so that advertisers can pay so that you will then turn around and want to buy their stuff.
Well, if Facebook is selling my eyeballs, what is it that would make me more or less valuable to Facebook?
The more information you provide, the more valuable you become. Because at this point, they now have more information to profile against you and know that you're a gun guy. I'm going to target more gun ads towards you. I know that you specifically like Article 15 clothing, for example, and I'm going to target Article 15 towards you. I know that you really like Triangle Tactical, and I'm going to target Triangle Tactical towards you. And then, on top of that, they can actually take the cross links of people you associate with and say, hey, they might like Triangle Tactical too, and target ads. Because ultimately, the real ads that really make money are the ones that get clicked. When somebody actually clicks through to the on the advertisement and actually goes to the destination, that's where the real transaction takes place.
If this is what Facebook is looking for, what's the intersection between Facebook and cybercrime?
The intersection between Facebook and cybercrime is the fact that Facebook's business is your information. Cybercrime's business is your information. Both dwell on congregating information. And the more information that's publicly available, the easier it is for a cyber criminal to go aggregate it and then use it against you. For instance, one of the big ticket items that is always tried to be compromised by criminals is the massive data collection that is kept by credit agencies. If you've never actually seen a full copy of the data that a credit agency has on you, it is downright scary. They have every last address you've ever been at. They have phone numbers, the whole nine yards. And when you go in to file for a credit application, they're actually using a lot of that data to verify you are who you say you are. Well, if you have that data stored in Facebook, for example, they can go and get it from Facebook, and it is probably considerably less secured than it is trying to go and break into the vault of a credit agency, for example.
So it sounds to me like less information is better, both in terms of making you maybe a little less valuable to Facebook, but also making you less easy to target for criminals. And also, this, I guess, goes back to that two-factor authentication to keep people from breaking into your Facebook and getting all the good information on you.
That's correct. Pay attention to how you're posting on Facebook. Remember, public means public. Everyone can see it. I don't really trust the security vectors on that at all anyway. But friends of friends can often see posts, and while you don't know who those friends of friends are, and even more important than that, though, just be generally vague. For the most part, there's no real reason to let somebody know exactly what street you live on. For all intents and purposes, as far as everyone's concerned, I live in Seattle. I don't actually live in Seattle, but it is enough of a geographic reference that my friends or mutual friends in the area, they know it well enough to know if, for one reason or another, they wanted to meet me in MeetSpace, they could drop me a line and it would probably happen. But it's vague enough that it is completely useless to somebody to try and use it against me.
All right, Baron. Good to have you. See you again next week.
See you again next week, Sean.
Baron still blogs at the-minuteman.org. So, Adam, how's this whole baby thing working out for you?
It's tiresome. There's lots of, you know, feedings and lots of not sleeping. For the first few days, my second son decided that 9 p.m. to 3 a.m. was dance party time. That's when everything is happening and I'm going to be awake the whole time.
I don't know. I kind of think 9 to 3 in the morning is dance time. I don't know.
Well,
not seeing the problem.
Yeah, I'm not in college anymore. Now, I'm an old man, okay?
Alcohol actually does work as a CNS depressant now.
Yeah. 9:30 is like my bedtime. Like, I'm really want to be passed out by 9:30. You know, I've got a 2.5-year-old. You know, things were kind of different when we had him. And now, you know, 2.5 years later, everything is, you know, there's a little bit more technology out there. I now have a video baby monitor thing it cost almost as little as my audio only baby monitor. So that's kind of cool. And they both have little like temperature sensors on them and stuff like that. So you can tell if they're too cold or they're too hot.
Oh, gee.
You know, just, you know, plays into the neurosis that's out there now. Oh my gosh. You know, we have to protect the child from every little possible thing. By the way, for any of our listeners who are going to have a child someday, you're going to want to not get the baby monitor that has like the little breathing detector thingy, because apparently those things don't work. Now, what this is there's a mat basically that you lay the baby on, and it somehow detects the chest rising and falling. Well, if your child is overdeveloped and can like lean over at all, it'll set that thing off. And we had a friend of ours say that was the longest 4 seconds of her life when that thing went off, saying that her child was no longer breathing. You know, it usually takes her about 10 seconds to get over there from her bedroom to that bedroom, but it was like 4 seconds and the child was just, you know, laying on her side. So don't do that. The other thing is, it's really hard to fit 2 car seats in anything that's older than like 2004.
They always told you, you know, you're going to have children, it's going to change your life. But wow. When I was a child, my parents drove a 1972 Ford Pinto, right?
Yeah, and that would not work now.
I sat in the back seat when mom was in the car, and my brother and I traded off sitting in the front seat, lap belt only, no shoulder harness, when it was just the three of us.
Yeah, that's child abuse now, or child endangerment.
I think it's child endangerment now if you let your child within 50 paces of a Pinto, much less drive them around in it.
Yeah. So the car seat thing is...
The car seat
thing is really weird. I think now it's like you have to be in a car seat until you're like 60 pounds or 10 years old or something like that. I mean, my kids, I joke, but only halfway, that they're going to be in car seats until they get their own car.
All right. I think it's 990. 9 years old or 90 pounds, you have to be in a booster seat.
Jeez. Yeah. That
we didn't have shoulder harnesses. Maybe they had car seats, but... What good's a car seat when, you know, the car blows up around you?
Right.
I mean, you know, dad wasn't driving a Corvair or anything, but geez. So, yeah. And how do you put a car seat in the back seat of a car if you don't have 4 doors?
Yeah, you don't. The buckets, which is what the infant seats are called, they actually have a base that you buy, and then you have the bucket that that plops into the base. That bucket is so large that on my 98 Cherokee, I had to make sure that I put that on the passenger side, because I have, you know, I got the 2 car seats now, and my front passenger seat is all the way forward, and that's the only way that bucket will actually fit in my car. So my Jeep, my 4-door 4x4, can now carry me and my 2 kids, and that's it.
The wife apparently gets to walk?
Yeah. Or, you know...
War on women.
There you go. My wife drives a 2008 Ford Taurus X, which used to be called the Ford Freestyle and is now called the Ford Explorer. Yeah.
How does that make any sense?
They discontinued the frame-mounted body truck Ford Explorer, and it's now like a uniframe mom wagon, starting in 2011.
Great.
Yeah, but that Taurus X, totally a mom wagon. The front seat, the front passenger seat has a little thing that you flip, and so the front seat will fold down so it's easier to get the bucket in. Like, I'm serious. That's why it's there.
Wow. And we wonder why children, when they get into college, are so self-centered. And we've taught them they're the center of the universe.
Yeah. You know, and it's crazy. The biggest thing that I worry about now is that, you know, I'm going to be out in public or, you know, maybe I'm going to be getting gas, right? And I'm going to turn around to, you know, pay the gas pump, and somebody's going to take a picture and say, oh, look, he's, you know, neglecting his child. His child is, you know, stuck in the car.
Yeah.
He's not in the car because I'm at the gas station.
Yeah. I can imagine the baby Gestapo is probably a little bit frightening for you.
Yeah, it is. It's actually very terrifying. Good for you and your wife for being tinks.
Well, I kind of miss the idea of having children, but I'm a little too old to start now.
Well, you know, there's always adoption, right?
I borrowed somebody's child for a little while. That cured me of the desire to have children in the house. I like kids.
Yeah.
I do like sending them home. Can I skip straight to being a grandparent?
Actually, I have a friend who did that.
Well, there you go. Well, Weird wants to talk about Think Progress, misrepresenting Stand Your Ground, Castle Doctrine, and Immunity all in one go. In this week in Anti-Gun Nuttery. So Weird, you found an interesting article. Why don't you tell me about it?
Yeah, I got this via Dave Hardy in, of armsofthelaw.com, and it's a Think Progress article, so it's got to be good stuff. And it starts off with a winner. It's got this headline. The headline reads, South Carolina prosecutors say Stand Your Ground doesn't apply to victims of domestic violence.
Oh my goodness. So domestic violence victims cannot avail themselves of the ordinary self-defense law of the state. That's horrible.
That would be really horrible if it was true.
If it was true.
The main story they talk about is a young woman who was breaking up with her boyfriend, and she came back to their domicile to collect her things before she left for good. And while she was there, her boyfriend attacked her, her ex-boyfriend attacked her. And she had a knife on her, and she ended up stabbing the guy, and he died.
If what she says is true, dude attacked her, I'm glad he's dead. I can't feel bad about that at all.
Nope, seems like a very, from what I've read, it seems like a very, very clean case of self-defense.
So this sounds like a perfect open and shut case of self-defense. What happened when it went to trial?
Well, she was granted stand your ground immunity because, you know, for the information given.
Well, yeah, but it's not really stand your ground immunity, is it?
No, it's technically just straight up self-defense.
So Think Progress manages to get all of the terminology incorrect. It's not stand your ground hearing, it's self-defense immunity. And it's not stand your ground at all because it was in a house. That's Castle Doctrine.
And it's not even Castle Doctrine because she was being attacked at the time.
And all Castle Doctrine actually says is what?
Is it Castle Doctrine says that if somebody forcibly enters your domicile, you can assume that they're meaning you harm.
Right, forcibly and unlawfully. Well, what's the possibility that somebody who lives in a home, has a key to the place, has entered the home forcibly and, critically, unlawfully? It's not possible, is it?
No, it's kind of the definition of living there. You tend to have a key and you have the right to come and go as you please.
What the prosecutor is saying is that we need to decide at trial what the facts of this case are. It doesn't fall under Stand Your Ground because it was inside a house. It doesn't fall under Castle Doctrines. You may assume you're under threat of death or serious bodily injury because the guy didn't enter the home forcibly and unlawfully. So it's basically a straight-up case of self-defense, which is exactly what she's claiming. Dude attacked her. She defended herself with the weapon. There we go.
Yep. Seems like a pretty open and shut case, but they're fighting.
Right. That's true. I can understand that in this case, the arguments that they're going to bring at trial are, number one, disparity of force. They're going to claim that the victim in this case was not using a weapon, so therefore her use of a deadly weapon was not proportional. And the counter to that is she's female, and women, for the most part in a fight, are not going to do as well as men in a fight. So it was perfectly okay for her in her case to use a weapon.
Yep, and given that they had just broken up, he has both motive and opportunity.
These laws really aren't that complicated.
No, they're not. I mean, Stand Your Ground simply states that if you're in a place that you have a right to be, you have no duty to retreat from a deadly threat. That's it. And Castle Doctrine simply says that if someone forcibly and illegally enters your home, you can immediately assume that they're meaning you harm. And that's it.
These are not that complicated. If these guys can't understand those simple laws, then they're either too stupid to be writing, or what they're really doing is they're just lying about it, and they hope that none of us are going to notice.
I know which one I think is true.
I know which one I think is true, too.
And now another thing that's often said by the same people that are against, let's face it, self-defense in general, is that Castle Doctrine and Stand Your Ground is a license to murder. It's not a license to murder because all of the laws of self-defense still apply. You need to be, be in fear of immediate bodily harm. The person must have motive and opportunity to do that. And I mean, as we've seen from several recent cases where Stand Your Ground was applied and the person got convicted of murder. Yeah, no, you can still get convicted if you murder somebody and claim that you were standing your ground and that you had a right to self-defense. It doesn't do anything. They can still prosecute you.
Have you ever wondered if maybe all these arguments and all the things that they complain about are really just a way to scare us so that we're just afraid to defend ourselves?
Oh, that could be, or it could just be that they don't believe in self-defense.
What are we arguing about here? We're not arguing that I need to have the right to own a physical object, a gun. We're arguing that we have the right to own them and use them when appropriate. And they want to take the tools away, but it seems like it's not the tool that really bothers them so much as it the ability to defend yourself.
Yeah, if you're anti-gun, it means you're anti-self-defense.
Well, weird, that's but just about says it all. It's good to have you. I'll see you next week.
It was a good time, Sean, and congratulations to Adam on his new baby.
In addition to appearing here, Weird is a regular host at The Squirrel Report and blogs at weirdworld.com. That's W-E-E-R-D world.com. Stuff that grinds my gears. The Security Theater at the State Fair in North Carolina.
So did you actually go to the State Fair?
Oh, I went to the State Fair. Have you not seen the video?
I have not seen the video. No, did you post that like today?
No, I posted a video yesterday. I'll have a link in the show notes. The fair gate that I went in is gate 8, which happens to be right next to the horse complex. The reason I went into that gate was because that's closest to the free parking in Carter Finley Stadium.
Okay.
Well, I walked in from Carter Finley Stadium, went through gate 8. I walked through a metal detector. I accosted is probably not the right word, but I had a female deputy step in front of me and look me in the eye from down there. She's a little shorter than I am. And she looks up and she says, "Are you carrying a knife or a weapons like pepper spray?" And I looked at her. I'm like, "No." And she's like, "Okay." And steps out of my way and I walk on. And I thought, well, that's kind of weird. I didn't take the keys out of my pocket. I didn't take my belt buckle off. Now, I go, as a course of my job, go into and out of prisons all the time. I can guarantee you that just my belt buckle will set off a properly calibrated metal detector, right?
Okay.
A standard roller buckle is what it is on an 1¾-inch belt. I'm like, all right, whatever. I go in, do my thing at the fair, meet up with my wife. We come out of the fair. Oh, did I tell you about the whole, you're not allowed to carry a concealed handgun in the fair. They banned it with no good reason as far as we could tell. And my revenge was to say, all right, you're banning concealed carry, so you have to escort me. And I got the chief of security for the agricultural chief of police, the guy who's the senior police officer at the fairgrounds, to agree that anybody who asked for a armed escort to their car in the parking lot would receive one.
I was going to ask if you did that.
Oh, not only did I did that, my wife did that. My wife was there for 3 days. My wife, on the first day, she went to the gate and says, "Hey, I want my escort to my car." And they looked at her kind of funny.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy's like, "Well, all right, sure." And he starts walking her to the car. So, nice deputy. She said he was very polite, very professional.
I'm sure.
And he's like, "So why am I giving you an escort to your vehicle? Are you carrying large amounts of cash?" My wife's like, "No. Do you have a boyfriend that I need to know about?" He's starting to scan the area like, is somebody sneaking up on us? And she's like, "No." He's like, "Well, then what do you need an escort for?" And she says, "Well, you told everybody that firearms and all weapons were banned. Basically, you just told everybody that I was an easy target out in the parking lot." He's like, "Oh, well, okay, I understand that." And he walked her to the car. It was very nice. My wife had nothing but praise for what a very nice deputy this man was. Well, the next day, she goes to the fair, and I'm coming. I can't remember which day it was, but it was the day that I went there. I get a phone call from her. "Well, I'm at gate 9, and these jerks won't give me an escort." "What do you mean?" She says, "Well, I went to the gate, and the guy at the gate says, no, I'm not going to give you an escort because, well, no, he was actually polite." She says, "I'm not going to give you an escort because I'm stuck here. Go into that building over there and tell the deputies that you need an escort." So she goes over to the building. Yeah, it's reasonable. The guy's working a post. He can't abandon his post just to walk my wife to her car. That's not really fair.
Plus, there's probably no real like policy or procedure because the guy just kind of came up with it to make you be quiet.
Right. Well, and the funny thing is these were sheriff's deputies and the sheriff was standing right next to Chief Keith and the sheriff went, "Yes, you have my guarantee as well."
Oh, okay. Well, good.
So I will back him up on this, is what he said. So they had no reason to argue this one because their boss, their elected official boss said, "Yes, this is what's going to happen."
Okay.
So she goes in, tells the deputies and they're like, "No." She's like, "But Chief Keith," and they're like, "No." So she calls me. "Well, I'm mad at these people. They're not giving me an escort." I'm like, "I just so happen to have Chief Keith's phone number." Turns out I didn't have his personal cell phone. More's the pity. What I had was the phone number to the public safety office. So I called the public safety office and I said, "Look, Chief Keith said that anybody who wanted an escort to their car would get an escort to their car. Now, my wife's at gate number 9. She's asked for her escort, and the deputies at the gate flat told her no. And she's like, really? Give me your phone number. And I said, yeah, and here's my wife's phone number too. She's like, I'll get right back with you. She hangs up. A few minutes later, I get a phone call from her. She says, your wife's not answering her phone. Chief Keith says to tell her to go back to the gate number 9, because she was headed to gate number 8. She says, go back to gate number 9, and he'll meet her there. I try calling my wife. I don't get an answer. Try calling my wife again. No answer. Finally, she calls me back. She says, I just had the weirdest phone call. She says, Chief Keith calls me. And I'm like, who are you and what are you trying to sell me? He says, this is Chief Keith. I am the chief of police for, where are you right now? Oh, you're at gate 8? If you will wait there just a moment, ma'am, I will be there in just a minute. And here comes Chief Keith trucking up. Hello, ma'am. My name is Chief Keith. I'm the chief of police for the Department of Agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
Here is one of my deputies, and she will walk you out to your car. So, I mean, you can't argue with that kind of service, right?
No, that's great.
Very nice.
That's great.
And then later on that night, when it was time for us to leave, we left fairly early, around 4:30. We go to gate 8, and I'm headed there, and I'm like, I'm not even going to bother asking these people. There was nobody there to ask. I mean, it's the guys working the gate. Pick up the phone, I call Chief, and I get the what? It was a male guy, a male on officer on the phone. He's like, no. He said, look, Chief Keith told me that we could have, and he's like, well, what's your name? And I told him my name. And since I, of course, was the guy who caused the trouble in
right,
the first
right,
place,
right.
He has no idea who I am.
Right.
No clue whatsoever. He turns around and somebody comes, he's like, just a minute. And clearly somebody had just walked in the door. Hey, so-and-so's at the gate. He says, Chief Keith said he could have an escort. And he gets back on the phone. Wait right there. Yeah, somebody be out there in a minute. I wait there for about 10. And while I'm waiting, I'm watching the security procedures because I had not stopped previously and watched the back of the security zone. Because, you know, typically you go through the security zone, you got places to go. You're not standing there watching them search people. Well, it turns out that I got the most security attention of anybody that I saw going through this. You know, this somebody standing in front of me and asking me if I had weapons was more than anybody else got.
Wow.
I watched people walk through the monitors and you can see them. I assumed that they were off because they weren't alarming. They weren't beeping.
Yeah.
Like every other one I've ever seen. No, they just turned the audio off. You could see them peg into the red as people were walking through and not being questioned. So I took a video of people walking through and like kind of having a brief discussion with the cops about what it is that, you know, where they're going. Somebody picked something out of a box, but we're not talking like they pulled out a wand and started wanding people. No pat downs, nothing. They were just like, this was security theater from start to finish. There was, if I wanted to carry a gun, really, it would have just been a case of try not to wear something so big that it was obvious what the bulge was.
Great.
Security
That's
is terrible.
That's great.
Absolutely horrible. Linoge, from Walls of the City, he took his wife to the fair and because they were taking some out-of-country visitors.
Yes.
And he watched the same thing. He's like, he didn't watch the back of it because, you know, who turns around and watches the lights go off? But he had the same experience. He said the security was terrible. It was theater. There's no security there. But if you or I were to carry a concealed handgun in accordance with what we believe the law to actually be, yeah, we'd all go to jail.
Right, right.
Yeah. So security theater, NC State Fair, very, very wrong answer.
Well, at least the chief kept his word.
Yeah.
Personally.
Yep.
I'm very impressed by that.
Yep.
So
yeah, it's Band-Aid over a gaping, sucking chest wound, but...
Yeah.
I mean, at least he had a Band-Aid.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, for this week, for me, the stuff that grinds my gears is people that order breakfast for their entire office, which isn't so bad, unless they do it in the drive-thru. Now, unless you're going to, like, Krispy Kreme or, you know, God forbid, Dunkin' Donuts. I'm in the South, I have to say, the Krispy Kreme.
Krispy Kreme suck.
Oh, we're gonna fight. So, you know, you can order... Krispy Kreme or Dunkin' Donuts for your whole office, and it's not that big of a deal. But if you're at Starbucks and you order 12 drinks, that's going to take a minute. And obviously, you're not in a hurry because you're ordering 12 drinks. So why don't you just go inside?
Because then you couldn't antagonize everybody who's in line behind you.
Oh my gosh, yes, yes. So when I was a contractor and I was going off to, you know, St. Louis every other week and going all over these places, get breakfast every morning at like McDonald's or Chick-fil-A or whatever. That would happen to me, you know, probably once a week where somebody in front of me, you know, would be handed 6 bags. I'm like, oh, come on. You know, I'm sitting in the drive-thru for like 10 minutes because you needed to order for, you know, everybody in your 30-person office. Just stop. Go inside. Same thing. My first job when I was in high school was at Taco Bell. And we would have people come through the drive-thru and order like 75 tacos. We're like, no, no, go inside.
Yeah, a little courtesy goes a long ways, guys. Get out of the drive-thru. I don't like drive-thrus for the reason that Joe Pesci said about drive-thrus, because they you know what to you with the drive-thru.
Let me tell you, can I give you two guys a friendly piece of advice, okay? Don't ever go up to the drive-thru, okay? Always walk up to the counter. You know what? Okay. Let me tell you. Okay. They f*** you at the drive-thru, okay? They f*** you at the drive-thru. They know you're going to be miles away before you find out you got f***ed, okay? They know you're not going to turn around and go back, so they don't care.
Yeah, so I don't like the drive-thru. Doesn't affect me, but I can see your problem.
Yeah. I'm finding myself going through drive-thrus much more now that I have a toddler.
Well, yeah. Oh, my goodness. Yes, definitely. Because
you can't leave them in the car.
You'd go to jail.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Well, that's our show for the week. Thanks again to Rob Allen for our music, and thank you for listening to the Gunblog Variety Cast. Constructive criticism can be sent to Sean at SeanSorrentino.com and hate mail to WizardPC@GunsCarsTech.com. Show notes can be found at gunblogvarietycast.com/episode10. We'll be right back.